Yeah, so Sprigna gave this really good introduction to, I guess, the sort of issues that you face when dealing with journalists and the issues we face dealing with scientists. And we thought it would be a good idea to have a couple of workshops, at least, that delve into specific interactions that journalists and scientists have. And I think the press release is probably a good way to start, because that's where I think you have your maybe first contact with journalists. The press release is sort of a frustrating thing for journalists, because the fundamental core value of news is to have it first. And when you get a press release, it's sort of bad news, because you've essentially, you've gotten the news, but so have all of your competitors. So it has benefits and demerits for us, and I think, especially with the advent of the internet, it's gotten a lot worse. So when newspapers were the only source of news around, aside from radio and television, journalists would get press releases at some point during the day. They would get a fax, and then the news cycle might involve two different issues of the newspaper, one in the evening and one in the morning, and you'd have plenty of time to contact people, report, go about, basically getting as many details and outside comment as you need, and then write your story. But since the advent of the internet and the sort of destruction of newspapers, things have changed a lot. We're not destroyed yet, but we're getting there. The news cycle is now not, twice a day. It's continuous. And there are a whole bunch of new news sources that have come into play. There are a lot of science bloggers who pick up papers and write about results, and they pick up press releases fairly often, and don't necessarily call anybody to get details on the work or anything like that. They usually just use quotes from the press release and find some new way of packaging the results and write a blog entry. And then there are news sites that also do a similar thing, and the turnaround for these things is fairly quick. So you get a press release, and maybe half an hour later, there's a news story online. So that places traditional journalists in a funny place, because we're not really, depending on your publication, you're really not allowed to do that. You use quotes from press releases. There are circumstances where you can do this, and you can excerpt something from a press release and, basically describe it as having been released in a statement. But for the most part, it's frowned upon. You're supposed to call other people, get outside comments, come up with a story that has, some depth to it. And you can't really do that with that kind of turnaround. By the time you've called your first person or your second person or identified the people that you need to talk to, there's already a story out online. So it's not the best thing for maybe traditional media that press releases are so widely distributed and so easy to get to. It's not the end of the world, though, because, there's plenty of stuff that's not press released. We get a lot of exclusives from papers, digging up, interesting journal articles, going to conferences. But I thought, it might be useful to know that, for the most part, unless it's huge news, traditional media is not likely to pick something up, just because of this difficulty of being able to turn around something quickly. So,
how are the press releases sent out to all those, to where the blogs get them?
So there are distribution lists, in the case of Science and Nature, there are press lists, and journalists with accreditation, which sometimes includes bloggers, can get embargoed access to press releases and to the journal articles themselves. So there are those distribution lists. There are certain membership societies that act as aggregators for press releases, and if you sign up with their media officer, they'll send you.
So something like the university would send it to one of those.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. But then there are also a whole bunch of different websites that do nothing but collect press releases. So with maybe some reporting as well, PhysOrg is a good example. They grab stuff from everywhere.
But they also put the press releases on their homepages, so everybody can see.
It's really hard to sort of wake up in the morning and think that you need to check the University of Iowa's webpage, But yeah, they're available in a million different ways, and some some people subscribe to Google Alerts for certain topics, so they'll you can find out about press releases that way as well. So that's basically, I just wanted to sort of set the stage for where press releases sort of fit in for journalists now. And Brigham and I were going to basically ask you all to sort of participate in an exercise. We wanted to distribute a few press releases to people, to if you wouldn't mind like teaming up into pairs. And we're going to ask you to read them over and pitch them as if you were a journalist. Sort of turning the tables. So if you all wouldn't mind teaming up.
Right now?
Yeah, right now.
Can you just make something up?
So we're going to hand out some press releases.
Hand out press releases?
Yeah. So. Is everybody ready?
No, what do you want us to do?
So we're gonna go through them. Is everybody trying to get these lights down but the rest of the lights up? So we're gonna go through starting with who is number one?
Number one.
Me.
Omaha's number one. I picked this for a reason and I'm giving you a very tough assignment, actually. So,
did you write this one? Is that why you picked it?
No. Well, I picked it.
But you say it's a pitch to the editor to write.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So.
Or not.
So, would you pitch this?
Okay. I think it's publishable.
Okay.
I would say, Hubble has seen a remote planet. 25 light years away. It's the first visible image of a planet around another star. It's an important discovery, an important event, and we should certainly write about it.
Okay.
And it's new. Is this something new?
It's the first. No, they had to change me, the editor. They had first. It's the first time they've seen it in the visible light. That's pretty remarkable, right? 25 light years, you can see.
So you can have a direct look at it. A direct look on it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I picked this for two reasons. One is that.
Very well done, Brian.
Yes, thank you. So I picked this for two reasons. One is that before this press release came out, there were maybe at least two or three other press releases saying the exact same thing. We've directly imaged a planet around another star. This one stands out because it was the first time that they directly imaged invisible light, a planet moving, so they were able to figure out its orbit. So they were able to say with definitiveness, or rather with relative definitiveness, that it's actually in orbit around the star instead of just some bright object that happens to be close to a star but isn't necessarily gravitationally bound to it. The other reason I picked this is because this paper came out in the same week as another paper that also appeared in Science, a paper imaging this system, which also found the motion of or moving planets and was able to say that they were actually gravitationally bound to the star. So what do you do? In this case, I've given you a hard assignment because when I got that press release, I also got both papers and a press release related to the other system. Right. But sometimes that happens, you only get one press release, you only get a small piece of the story or whatever, and you've got to pull it apart. So does anybody?
Do you get this? Do you go out and look for other press releases to see, try and determine for yourself that this is really unique?
Yeah.
Kind of background.
I mean, in this case, I've covered exoplanets before, so I automatically started thinking about what had come before. But yeah, I mean but sometimes you don't know, right? You don't know what to look for. You don't know what's.
But they're not claiming to see a planet.
They're not claiming to see a planet.
Now, I'm not saying the press release isn't.
Right.
I'm saying what the scientists are. They're saying this is way too bright to be a planet. And therefore, we hypothesize that there's this huge ring around the planet reflecting the star's light, and that's what we're seeing.
So it's not even a direct detection.
It's not a direct detection of a planet. It's not clear what's going on.
The press release is very clear.
Is the planet not hot enough to produce?
No, this is visible light, so it's not. The planet's not hot enough to be radiating in the visible. So it's reflected light. That's the interesting thing about it. But you need far greater surface area to be that bright in reflected light than you could have for any type planet.
That's the trouble with scientists.
That's not a nice story.
If I could write my stories with footnotes, I think that would help a lot.
Another cool thing about the system, right, this press release is that it was predicted that there should be a planet there, and then they looked and saw it, which is somewhat different from these other previous observations you're talking about, right?
Maybe that's a better
answer. Yeah, I remember previous images of that eyeball-looking thing up there, the ring in the system, and where you couldn't quite make out the planet because they didn't have enough data. And then there's images of that in books. And then after the subsequent data, where you can see the little dots on the right, the inset. I went back and looked at the older images, and you can sort of see there might be something there or not. It is pretty interesting.
Let me tell you how I digested it for a different purpose, which is writing a graduate student textbook, which has to last for a long time. And that is, I said, that other discovery, that's good. This, we don't know exactly how massive the objects are, etc., but we know what's going on to first approximation, and it can be put in the textbook. The formal hot one is such a stretch that it may be proven wrong on a time scale short compared to the lifetime of the textbook, not compared to the lifetime of the news cycle.
Fair enough. Okay, so moving on, who has number two?
I have two, but we didn't discuss number two.
Okay.
I have two.
Lars, do you want to go first?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Okay, good. So I would not pitch this whatsoever to an editor. My story would have been, spacecraft comes within 25 kilometers of the surface and doesn't hit. my pitch if I were to write a story. Because I think there was almost no context whatsoever for why this was of interest. And the image they gave was such an artist's impression. They have an image which shows the spacecraft kind of blowing, you can't see it, but it looks like Hollywood with lights coming up and a spacecraft going by. So it would have been better to say spacecraft comes within 25 kilometers without hitting Enceladus.
Did the spacecraft go by Enceladus? This is 14th of April with the press release, but it seems to be associated with a meeting which suggests that this is a digested data from that encounter which occurred a long time ago. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, the point is that they failed, so that there was no scientific message here worth communicating to the public.
But this, the one that you're trying to communicate might have been two-year-old news by this time.
But it hadn't hit.
That it had gone by that close and then survived the encounter.
Right.
So
you guys have a different perspective now.
Almost all this is background, and then there's one little paragraph that says, I guess, what the conclusion was. It's really unclear why it's interesting.
So, when I got this press release, I read the first paragraph, because the second paragraph is all background, right? It's very clear. You're like, oh, you're describing Enceladus. But there's no, usually like a well-structured press release will have a news lead, just a sentence saying what the news is, and then it'll have a second sentence that'll give you the implications, like the why should we care sentence. And this doesn't have it, right? So I was just like, too much work. So
you didn't read the rest.
I read it before we met. But
you told us to read it, so I read it.
I just wanted to, give you a sense of like how we process these things. So was the flyby in any way special? Does it say anything about that? I don't remember. Was it the closest flyby?
It doesn't say the closest, but I mean, 25 kilometers is pretty close. Yeah. The way I read it, I didn't really pick up on that, but yeah. Well, it sounded like skin surface of ocean-bearing world could be a good headline.
Right, exactly. Just for a navigational headline.
Yeah. Right. Except you can see he's been successful for so long and has not run into so many wounds.
Right. This is probably the closest encounter it has done with any moon. But then again, it's not, as I said, it's not clear that this is news. I don't know when the encounter occurred from this.
No, I think it's saying it's made 9 flybys.
That was 25.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, enough said.
Yes. All right. Who has number 3? Okay. Do you want to go first?
Okay. I should say whether I would pitch this or not to an editor, right?
Yeah.
And probably not for a whole story. It's kind of. It's not. It seems like they observed something, but it wasn't clear what the conclusion should be. What did they actually learn about the interior of the neutron star? Well, I mean, it's at an interesting stage. The observation is interesting, but...
So is the observation new, or something that people haven't been able to do before?
Okay, so they claim that this is not especially close to my field, so... It says it's the first time they've had such a long baseline observation of a cooling young star. Okay. I mean, like, if I were reading this in a paper in a journal, that would be, sure, it'd be interesting, but I don't know that I would put it in a paper, like a newspaper.
Okay. Just so everybody, Lynn Ho will be here next week, so we should be a little bit polite.
Do you guys agree?
Yeah, so we had the same sort of comments that essentially, the cool part is that they could measure the cooling of a neutron star in only 10 years of observation or something like that. But the scientifically interesting part is more down in the, I don't know if it shows up on the screen there, which is basically explaining how it's been cooling over time. But that paragraph is just completely, it's not easy to understand. And it just basically says we compared the data against models and it didn't quite work. There must be other processes going on. And so it's not it's not exciting at all. It's not it's not easy to understand why it's exciting in a press release sense. But what would be cool is to say, hey, yeah, like this, what's I freaking say, like that this is a laboratory that we can't access on Earth, and so we can actually learn a lot about how neutron stars work, and we have no other way of doing that, and this is the first time we're able to do that. In principle, that's the first time. I don't know if it's true or not.
Yes, and it had the appeal of being a kind of simple test they're doing. They're just watching something cool, which is something everybody can relate to, perhaps. And so we actually liked mostly how it was composed as a press release, so whether or not we would want to write the story. Like the last full paragraph you can see on the screen, neutron stars are composed mostly of neutrons crushed together. That paragraph is just very well written and kind of describes the basic setup in an accessible way.
But then the quote under it is horrible. It's like a whole paragraph quote that tries to explain the science, and you should really explain the science separately, and then just have a high impact quote that's one sentence long or something.
There's no way that's a quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, this suggests that they hashed this out over email, this quote, but maybe not. When I read this, I didn't know what to do with it, and so I just basically passed it by quickly, but flying through this paragraph is good background information to have for future stories. Because, it has nice figures in it, right? A million times the density of lead. That's useful. Although I could probably look it up if I needed it. So. All right, are we on to number four? Who's number four? Does anyone have number four? That's good, because this is complete rubbish.
We'll move on.
Five.
We have five.
Okay.
No.
Anyone?
Guys have five?
Yeah, so I didn't know how, as a reporter, how much background information I should have. Okay, so this tells us about the refined mass measurement of the W boson, and it's interesting because it could lead us to more information about the Higgs boson, which is really the, you know, the holy grail, I guess, right? That's what everyone, physicists are really interested in, but they don't explain why the Higgs boson is interesting, which, I don't know, maybe reporters would know that or would know to look up Higgs boson. This is the most important thing. So that was our, I guess, one of our main criticisms.
Yeah, to my eye, there was nothing. So the Tevatron, there's no explanation of what the Tevatron does. And then there was no explanation of why measuring the W boson's mass is at all important for the Higgs. It says it portends stricter limits for the Higgs particle, but not why. And it was too technical in some spots and didn't include any sort of physical motivation for what's happening. And it's just a number that was measured from something that nobody's ever heard of. And for some reason, that's important.
Also, as a secondary thing, you know, it's basically said a bunch of scientists unnamed did this stuff.
Unnamed scientists.
Yeah, so.
No, they go to D0.
Sorry, because there's 200 people.
Yeah, you can't say the D0 team led by.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. It's so there's no person for the reader to connect to, you know? I mean, it's technical to begin with, but if I'm a reader and I don't, you know, there's no person in there.
550 physicists.
Yeah.
But I mean, the quote by Chris Quigg that this beautiful measurement illustrates the power of the Tevatron as a precision instrument and means that the stress test we have ordered for the standard model becomes more stressful and more revealing. It contains no information, right? There's nothing about anything contained in that quote. It's kind of amazing.
It contains information, and it's a beautiful measurement, and we have done it. And we are very good scientists.
But what is the measurement? I mean, why? Like, what's the point, I guess?
But I would have taken just the first part of that. I would, if we were right, sorry, I'd say the beautiful measure illustrates the power of the Tevatron. Just end it there, right? Because the rest is blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly.
But it makes it sound like it's important to something that has no clue what's going on. Yeah. And, you know.
What is the stress test for the standard model? What is the standard model? and why does it become more stressful and more revealing?
But do you want to be a take the propaganda from the Tevatron, which they're not really justifying, they're just accepting it on face value?
You're a journalist, what are you going to do?
And I mean, like, the error bars, are they really necessary?
Every journalist knows.
And three significant figures after
It seems like they wanted to get this out before they received got up and running, and they got the results from the NAC. No one would care about the Tevatron.
This is a press release that I think is something the press office likes to release more for accounting purposes, so that they can go back to the Department of Energy and say, you know, this is an example of progress that we've been making. Yeah, for journalists it's tough. Although, I mean, it is a little tantalizing, and it might tempt me to call up somebody at Fermilab and ask them whether this places more stringent, what the new stringent limits on the Higgs are. And chances are, I would call somebody up and they would say, oh, we haven't done the calculations yet. So, but I mean, it's good to know, but so not worth a new story?
I wouldn't push it.
All right, and then we're on to six, is that it?
Yeah, it's ours.
Okay.
The first thing that struck us is that it talks all about these neutrino experiments, but never suggests what a neutrino is or why it might be of any interest or importance. And so without some additional background digging on the part of somebody writing a potential article, it certainly couldn't use this naked to produce an article.
And even a journalist who might know about neutrinos wouldn't feel necessary. There's one thing about, oh yeah, I've heard of these things, and there's another with feeling comfortable enough about them to make up your own one sentence description that is right and compact and easy. So that should have been put in there if anybody cared about the science. But there are quotes from congressmen in here, so if it's just a bunch of hot air, because they're just opening this new dedication, or it's not even that. It's they're breaking ground for something, and there's not going to be any science for years.
If I were the Minnesota Gazette reporter, then I would definitely cover the story.
This is of interest to people who want to know what that hole is doing. And if you care beyond, if you're beyond passing that hole on your drive to work, then it becomes a lot less interesting. Although the congressmen clearly want their voters to know that they got the pork that's going into that hole.
That's actually very interesting. Who put out the press release? Was it scientists or was it government office?
I believe this is
Fermilab.
I think this is probably Fermilab press offices. Which I think are public affairs office.
Well, so you wouldn't go forward with this? That would be you might if you were the newspaper in the local area, because people there are.
I think if you investigated it, you'd go forward with it.
It seems like the main point of this is not actually science, but is economics, right? I mean, and that's in the first sentence. It's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and this is going to be workers, and this is going to be jobs.
There is a lot of politics in big science, but still, this is a step worth noting. You know, Bill Foster is a congressman, and he's a PhD physicist, one of the few in Congress, worked at Fermilab, got elected as a Democrat in a Republican district, and he understands science. So it's not just a bunch of hot air from Congress.
Well, his quote certainly is a little bit more informed than the Oberstar quote.
It's not a great press release, but I think it's definitely worth reporting if you investigated it. You may not get it out of this article, but it's important.
I mean, I agree that sometimes experiment starts are very good things to cover. It's tough though when you're writing a new story like that, because the question you get from editors a lot and the question readers want to know a lot about is what it's going to find, right? But, and this is, most experiments, you can't predict in advance what it's going to find. So
you see list quotes about fundamentally expanding our understanding of neutrinos and strengthen blah, blah.
But that's not something that you can put in a news story without backing up with more details, right?
Yeah, there is information to be had elsewhere, but it's not here.
Yeah. Because then the readers say, well, why is my smart tax dollars being spent on finding out more about neutrinos when I don't even know what they're looking for? What is the point of the experiment? Why am I paying for it?
Your reporters love to put how much saying costs. Which always annoys us, because then people always go, why do you spend my money that way?
Well, it creates a lot of jobs in an area where there probably aren't many.
Yeah, well, if you get one of the jobs, you like it. You're paying for the jobs.
Well, no, but the idea is
that's what
we're talking about in this constituency.
I think you should move on.
All right. Okay. So those were all of the press releases. Some of them are, some of them are tough, and I would never write a story on them. And others are distracting, and still others are actually really, really good news, and worthy of where they're digging. But this is what we have to deal with on a daily basis.
My experience has been that if you actually, the question is, what's the intent? So if a scientist wants to try to get the information out to the public, let's presume it's a sort of a pure, you know, pure goal.
Yeah.
You know, the question is, how do you get that information out sort of maximally? And, you know, one way is to, you know, I call up my favorite science reporter and I say, I want to give you a scoop. I'm not going to do a press release. Instead, I'm going to give you the story and you write it. And then I'm single point failure depending on your ability to get it published somewhere.
Although if I don't, you could always go to another reporter.
Right.
Or
right.
Secretly call up 10 reporters with your
I don't know how they heard that.
Right. So, I mean, so this is, in my mind, this is the question is, you know, I don't see a way other than press releases today to actually get the information out.
Well, it comes down to how you define maximal impact, right? Like, if your press release.
I want my mother to see it. Let's say it. That's
okay.
My break here.
She won't read it no matter where it appears.
No, you know, it's.
You set up
a Google alert, and then you see, or you do a Google News search, and you see how many places picked up the identical article. There's no new content anywhere generated, right? It's literally a transmission exercise.
Right.
Put something in the system, and see how many stories you get out the other end. But they're not new stories.
Right.
Just copies, cut and paste copies. And you know, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 500.
Right.
But there's no new content generated by any journalist anywhere in the system.
In this sort of repeating press release.
Right. You do a press release and it just gets cut and pasted and copied. And everybody reads the story, however poorly written it was, by the press officer or the scientist.
But is that something you want? I mean, wouldn't you prefer to have maybe two or three like high quality news articles that get forwarded to friends and sort of...
Yeah, in my experience, there's often like this first tier, there's like half a dozen really good reporters who call around, write their own story,
correct,
get their own quotes, do everything right.
Right.
And then there's, and get people to comment on whether this is, get negative quotes about it or whatever. And then there's this other like continuum. I mean, maybe there's like 200 sites that will just post the press release.
Right.
So there's both.
I mean, they're superficial readers too. So if there's some way to do both, I don't know how you do it, but that would be something. Like when Kepler's first results came out earlier this year, I was covering it in DC and I came home and it had been all over the news because they had released their first planets. And my father met me at the door and said, did you know they found some new planets? I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah, so that brings the total up to what, like 12, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, like maybe in-depth stories that actually have outside comment and are well-balanced are like, I mean, it's definitely gonna be a subset of the population, like people that have the patience to sit there and read it and value that kind of content, but I don't know. What's better for you, like in terms of news coverage? I mean,
so my experience started when Glanz, who is an excellent writer, was at, I forgot, it was either Nature or Science, before he went to the New York Times, he had clearly a Rolodex, and he would call. And he would call me three or four times a year, and he'd just say, what's up? And he would just troll for stories, and he would write stories that he came up with on his own, independent of press releases. That's probably why he ended up at the New York Times, because he was actually doing his job. And he actually wrote an article in Science or Nature about how bad press releases were. It's actually interesting to read it. So it was a commentary. It was an article about how NASA tries to manipulate the press, and because many times he would scoop NASA and he would get slapped around by NASA saying, how dare you scoop us? You wrote the story before we did the press release. Not to him, that was victory, right? So he got the story before they even came out with it. But I mean, how many people are working at, have the luxury of an income and a stability of job to do that level of work? This is,
There are other ways of getting stuff out besides press release. It's just that most people, I mean, it's the easy way to do it is by press release, right? But like, there are meetings that, I mean, a lot of news organizations send reporters to the meetings. And, you know, while there are press conferences at meetings, there's also sometimes you see reporters out in the poster session at the AAS just talking to people. Or there, I've talked to reporters that have called me up after just reading Astro PH and saying, hey, I saw this paper on blah, blah, blah. Is that interesting? You know, and there are other, people that have these relationships with scientists that just, you know, dig stuff up. So I don't know. If you're a good reporter, it seems like there's lots of ways. But the most, by far, the most common, like 98% or something of stories are just picked up press releases, it seems like, or slightly modified press releases.
But I think from a scientist perspective, one of the things we sometimes need to learn is that our deadlines are usually not as close called as all the reporters who call you or so. So you need to reply, at least that's what I find very helpful, within an hour, a couple of hours max, if you want to actually change something. If you say, look, this would be interesting. And I think the problem is that in our community as scientists, we're not used to that. We want to give you an in-depth story. I'm sending you 3 pages with the background, but that means these people already missed all their deadlines. So, you know, if you want to, I think one of the things I learned when I was talking to people who wrote excellent stories, but they wanted input, really. They wanted input, they wanted good quotes, they want to get a reputation of getting it straight, but they need it now. They don't need it tomorrow. And a lot of times they forget, for journalists, they forget to tell you that they need it by 6 p.m. In an hour thing that's like, oh yeah, I'll put this together, I'll send this tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, and you're already too late. So I think that's also one of the disconnects. Like, as a scientist, I think the most important thing is to reply like that. You know, just a short email, say this and this, and they'll get back whether or not they missed their deadline already or they're not. I think this is one of the, in addition to the press releases, in addition of getting your work covered, one of our biggest issues. That you actually have to work on a different time scales generally.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, when it comes to exclusives, like, it's not really an issue. But if, I mean, I don't really write many stories off of press releases. But when I do, you know, I need quick turnaround time. And I've actually found that like it's far easier to get people to comment if you don't say I need this by 6. I guess people just feel rushed or whatever. So there's a little bit of a psychological game where I'm trying to express urgency without putting pressure on people. But yeah, I mean, it is definitely like turnaround time for these things is huge. But it would help with coverage a lot. Yeah.
I got something, an email earlier this week. And I think I had left a little early one afternoon. And I got it in the morning. And the first thing I did was, does it still matter? And he said, no, I got it. I've done my story. Because it was 18 hours ago. 16 hours ago.
Yeah, I think one of the most helpful things is if you know you can't respond to a reporter in time and there's just no way you can do it, just send them a quick email back and being like, I am swamped. Like, there's no way I can comment. Because that, I don't know. Well, lets us go and find other people. Not that we're hinging on any one person to comment, but it's helpful to get a sense of who's available.
But I mean, the other issue I've seen is that, I mean, it'd be interesting to see, I mean, there's data, so someone could answer the question, but the strong impression one gets is that when the reporter writes the article that scooped everybody else, because of that, it doesn't actually get any additional stories written. It's kind of that's it.
Actually, I mean, I found the opposite. Like, okay. Especially if it's a good, juicy story, people will write their own stories.
In science? About scientific topics?
Yeah, yeah. That's a good example. I wrote Planetary Society last year wrote a story about a GRL paper that was in press, and anyone could have seen, but they were the first to pick it up on finding a skylight on the moon, basically a hole that was poked into a lava tube. So they wrote a story on it. I picked it up and wrote a story on it, and then there was an avalanche of other news coverage. So, I mean, it wasn't I didn't pick it up to begin with. I picked it up from the blog. But, so those kind of things.
Because that's the argument NASA gives.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you.
Yeah.
The reason they would argue that they'll always want to do control the press and do a press release is they're convinced they get more coverage by doing a press release than not.
I would love to see those numbers.
Isn't there another reason for that, though, which is to create an artificial moment for a news event when in fact, of course, there's no news of LHC, but you just say, well, we're going to switch it on, such and such, and that's going to be the news event, and you have control of that, and you turn something, you create your own deadline, you create a very fast, you know, sharp timescale, as if something had just happened, and it's news, whereas the fact that one knew was going to happen 6 months before that is not news. And if you don't manage the kind of information flow in that way to create this pretend moment, then you don't get, journalists won't pick it up, at least the scientific journalists might, but the wider ones will definitely not, because it's not today's news. And what the last thing they want to do is publish last week's news. So you have to make sure that it's kind of artificially today's news, and which is very unscience. I mean, there's nothing really today about scientific discoveries usually.
Yeah. Good point.
Nature and science, I think, are good examples of that, too.
They manage it the same way.
Yeah. They figure they can, and they do, get a lot of coverage because they embargo their papers. And I mean, that's sort of a controversial subject in the journalistic community. I sort of like being able to take a little time for stories because, on the off chance, there is an important paper in science that takes a little time to dissect, but other people think it's, I don't know, it's creating sort of an artificial environment for journalism. So.
What's your target? You're talking about writing for the New Scientist, for a readership of, and what audience are you writing?
So it's a readership of mostly just science savvy people. So our biggest audience, at least in terms of print subscribers, is in the UK, and there are a lot of people with science backgrounds who are subscribers.
So that's weekly.
Yeah. But we also have, you know, a website, and we're trying to post stories as often as possible on that as well.
Say a few words about how to write a good press release, because I've either written a lot myself or helped colleagues on writing them, and you know, I never went to journalism school to do it, but I guess I generally have the basic idea, but I've seen some terrible ones, and it seems like journalists don't often know how to write them that well, or press offices don't often know how to write not journalists because they're on the other end, but press offices, man, I've seen such a wide disparity in competence involving writing press releases.
Well, people come to press offices from like very different backgrounds, so that might be part of it. I think a really good press release is structured exactly like a news story, so like the most important thing you can do is have a very good first paragraph, because that's the first thing people are going to see. And if it doesn't make sense to them, if it's confusing, or if it's just not informative or there's no real news, they won't even bother with the rest. So I would say, I mean, the most important thing is to have maybe something more correct than this, but just a two sentence lead. This doesn't even have a two sentence lead actually, but. Actually, I don't know if I had an example in there.
The neutrino one has like two sentences at the beginning. Neutron star.
The second sentence is just announcing where they're going to present.
Right, so that's, like, I don't know, like, are you supposed to do that? Is there, like, some kind of stylistic thing that says you should announce the meeting then, you put the meeting farther down? Like, do you put the quotes generally, like, I don't know, it seems like most of them put them sort of two-thirds of the way down the press release, or...
Yeah, I mean, at some point, quotes are good, but, I mean, if I were to write this, I wouldn't put the... place where it's being presented that high up. Because people, if they find this paragraph interesting, they'll root around through the rest of the press release to figure out why it's news, whether it's being presented at a meeting or it's a new paper or something else. So I would have replaced the sentence with implications if there were any, because that would give the highest impact. I mean, there's no real like rule book for press releases.
But
for
the
news
first
stories,
sentence is almost right?
Yeah.
That's interesting because, you know, what little I learned about journalism was you're supposed to answer these questions: who, what, where, how, when, why, in the beginning of an article. If you take away the second sentence, you don't answer those. So you're telling us that those rules are out the window.
I think they are.
They should be.
Well,
yeah.
The name of the scientist is very rarely of interest to not like leadership.
I mean, I think like...
The location is science. I mean, science happens everywhere, right? This meeting where it's announced, it's almost irrelevant.
I mean, that's that a rule is
timely and important.
Yeah, that's why you should write about it now.
Yeah. But yeah, you do want this announced today. This is this thing about the artificial moment. So you want in results announced today, the world has changed. You know, that's what that should say, right? And then if it's in results announced 3 months ago, then obviously people know the world hasn't changed, so they're not going to read any further.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be the second sentence. I mean, I don't think it really matters for this result.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could get away with saying new observations suggest, or a new simulation suggest, or something like that. Yeah, I think that structure, the who, what, when, where, and why, if there's a why, is really good for like newspaper writing, especially things like crime reporting, where you want as much information as possible, like very early on. You want to know what happened and where it happened as soon as possible. But for science writing, like it's a little more leisurely. It requires so much explanation and background and setup that you need to sort of draw people in and give them little breadcrumbs they can follow, because otherwise they'll get lost very, very quickly. And also, nobody really needs to know the scientist's name right off the bat, because they don't know the scientist.
Can we go back to the Omaha one? Because it only had one kind of sense of intention to leave. I mean, there's a second sense there. And so here, the estimated no more than 3 times Jupiter's mass, the planet called Fomalha B, orbits the bright southern star Fomalha, located 25 light years away, and that's what he sees, whatever. So, to astronomer, things like the 25 light years away, the constellation, are totally irrelevant. So if I had been writing this, I never would have thought of that. But that's kind of my press officer would ask me how far away is what constellation is. I'd be like, argh, because I know we can put this in. So is that good or is that bad?
It's good.
Okay.
I mean, I mean, it's not useful to you, because I guess it doesn't really help you plan observations or anything like that, but people want to know where it is on the sky. They want to know if this is something that they can see, how far away it is. I mean, this is almost not enough context, right? Like, I don't think people have a good sense of how much 25 light years is.
No, but I mean, so there's a very practical way that that's relevant. So if you're interested in like space in general, you might say 25 light years, oh, we could actually travel there, right? Within a generation. No, I mean, yes. People might think that.
And like you were saying, your father thought it was in our solar system. So, I mean, you've got to at least tell people that it's outside of that.
You get the astrologers into it as well. You see Pisces. getting readership.
Yeah, I mean, I find that information interesting just because it makes it more physical, right? It's a real object. It's floating out there. It's
actually, I have a question about that then, about the comet. So how much pressure is there put on you as a journalist to sort of portray or artificially create conflict within the community about a new discovery?
For me, very little, like nothing. I don't know about other journalists. I think, in general, there's like a good faith effort to portray the community as accurately as possible. You know, and I very seldom see stories, well, you know, and some people have very strong opinions, but I very seldom see stories where somebody's like tried to stir up controversy, you know, and like, I definitely never see like libelous statements.
You know? Yes,
so has never written an accurate paper in his life or anything like that. You know, like,
I mean, this doesn't break his record.
That's because you're not writing about global warming.
But yeah, I think criticism is a useful thing, because otherwise, and I think that more accurately portrays scientific progress, because things very seldom are, as we can see with this one, so clear and cut and dry. Like, there's going to be back and forth in the community for years to come, and you want to be able to portray that. I think that's a good thing to draw out. I mean, there's an elegant and graceful way to do it, and a not so elegant and graceful way to do it.
So in relation to this comment, the story of global warming probably takes on a very different dimension from the vantage point of the reporters who are talking about it.
I mean, this is almost pedestrian in comparison to the type of vitriol that seems to exist in this debate. How do you all approach this problem when you sit and make editorial decisions about how to tell this story, how to write it, how to get commentary from other sides of the story? Because it's so political in so many fundamental ways.
You know, I mean, I don't cover climate, so it's hard for me to say, but I would say there's generally, like, the reporters who cover things, very controversial subjects, have a good sense of how big certain sides of the debate are, like what constitutes a scientific consensus, whether there is one, where people are coming from when you ask them. So they'll provide that context and stories if they can. I mean, the climate scandals have been all over the British media, and they've been hyping up the controversy, but I think they're not really trying to cover the science so much as just cover the argument.
But they're not, the climate scandal is an artificial thing. There were emails which were not talking about fraud. They were talking about details on how they're analyzing things, and you're getting a fair and balanced perspective on those emails.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about, I mean, this is not my beat, so it's hard for me to say, but it does seem like there has been a fair amount of...
Well, more generally, a scientific discovery often raises a bunch of new questions, and what would you say about the relative value of portraying something as ending a story as opposed to portraying it as opening up new mysteries and new questions?
I feel like I've written a lot of stories that do both, you know? Like, yes, we've closed this chapter, and now we have a whole bunch of new questions. But, it's hard. I don't think that very many new stories come across as being definitive, or at least, I mean, I try not to make them sound definitive, but...
I guess sort of gets to the point, I mean, you mentioned that, the story of another five retrograde planets or something, that wasn't interesting because it wasn't new anymore. And so once we have a population under 100, maybe we'll finally have a conclusion, but at that point, it's not new. If you want to be new, it'd be the first one. But the first one really has no clue what it means.
Right.
And so...
Yeah, but however, in the case of identifying planets, you know, when you identify that first planet, that's a huge step for humanity as a whole, right? Finding five more planets after you found 100 planets, it's not a huge step for humanity as a whole. It might be a huge step for planetary science, but not for, like, a deep philosophical implication.
But I guess I'm saying, if you want to cover the answering the questions, you'd have to run a story after they found 100.
Right.
If you want to cover the first one, there's no conclusion. It's all about this will be interesting because it opens doors to study, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But that's probably why I don't write a lot of stories about, like, statistical arguments about why something must be true or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're just simply because they're harder to top line, you know? I mean, I think that's an interesting thing. Like, we covered the first retrograde exoplanet when it was found, and the second one when it was reported, like, a day later. There's definitely a news story there, right? That I mean, you could say one or two of them are just like oddballs, but if it turns out that there's like a sizable population, that represents a shift in the community. It's just really hard to headline those stories, right? It really just sort of comes down to like how do you make a news story out of this thing, right?
So can you say, like, yeah, based on a bunch of different press releases, like, what fraction or what kinds of stories really get turned into good stories? Like, is it, the sort of eureka moment, discover something, or, like, I don't know, like, in my experience, like, black holes, like, everybody loves black holes. Or something about Einstein, everybody, like, they always pick up Einstein things, black holes, speed of light. Like, there's a couple of things, and then there's a bunch of stuff that's, like, never written about, which is fine, because it's boring. Like, Interstellar Medium, who cares? But, you know, like, I don't know, like, is there, or I don't know, anything to say about that?
They're definitely, like, yeah, I mean, exoplanets are always covered, I think, and definitely Einstein, definitely black holes, the nature of time. I mean, a lot of these subjects, especially those sort of subjects, are really hard to cover properly from a press release. So, I don't know.
But it also seems like, I mean, this is obvious, right? But press releases are always about observation rather than theory, right? It's the theory that motivates. But do you ever see a press release about, hey, some scientists ran a new computer simulation and have some pretty pictures to show?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
Really?
Yeah, I've done one. So I have a question. Sorry, I missed most of your talk, so if you addressed this, I apologize. But so there seems to be a trend to use all kinds of ridiculous analogies to different physical processes to, you know, have people understand it a little bit better. Like, what's an example? I remember reading something, it was so ridiculous I didn't even read the article. It was something like neutron star burp gets astronomers excited or something. So my question is, do you find this helpful or harmful in terms of getting people interested and, you know, getting to the meat of it?
I mean, we tend to use them in headlines, just because they're short and sweet. They may not be the most accurate analogies or ways to picture things, but I think they're helpful.
Because I notice also that
we can't use the technical term a lot of times, right?
Right, so a lot of the quotes that you get are just analogies of how some physical process works.
Yeah. I mean, do they grate on you to see?
No, I was just wondering, like, if I were to write a press release, would I have a better chance if I used some kind of very simple analogy?
Yeah, I think you'd have the best chance if you used a very simple, like, visual analogy and at the same time gave, like, a more in-depth explanation. So you cover your bases. Because if it's too simple and I don't have a good understanding of what's going on, I'm not going to cover it. So it's nice to have both, right? A way to visualize it and also better understanding what's going on.
And if you can make it analogous to a black hole somehow.
There you go.
And there are certain topics that are just like really, really tough to cover, like magnetic reconnection.
Yeah.
Right? Like, very important process, very, very hard to explain to people. It's just really hard to visualize. So in that case, like,
yeah, of course.
Some sort of basic analogy would be helpful.
But is that even really a story that anybody wants to hear? Right? Like, because the stories, as Andy was saying, stories basically fall into two categories. Philosophical stories about the deep meaning of the universe. Dark matter is another one that Andy didn't mention that constantly comes up in the press because it's from a big part of the universe we don't understand. So deep things about the universe we don't understand and giant explosions are the two sort of fields that people want to hear most about, right?
Or no,
where giant explosions include
discoveries in general that are like a new thing, like, you know, planets or any.
Yeah, but planets is a deep philosophical thing about the universe.
Yeah.
The interstellar medium is not a philosophical thing about the universe, and neither is magnetic reconnection. So therefore, they never get talked about in the press. Fair or unfair, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, on occasion, right? If you're writing like a story about solar storms or something like that, it might come up. Yeah. So, but yeah, in general.
Yeah, then there's that last line, like, it's predicted that your cell phone will not have any trouble on the day that the storm passes. Right.
Well, I think we've gone way over, but thank you all for this.
Thank you.